You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. Hey guys, and welcome to this special edition of the OCD Stories podcast. Now, this is the second special midweek episode in October. If you missed last week's one, I'm doing four of these extra episodes throughout October. So they'll still be the usual Sunday episode hosted by me. But these midweek special episodes have a guest host. And this week is Chrissy Hodges. Now, many of you will be familiar with her, but she does a good job of introducing herself at the start of the episode, so I won't do it now. And she chose to interview Chance McNeely. Chance has been on the podcast before, and I'll put that link in the show notes. And again, he introduces himself in the episode. But in it, they talk about Chance's story, how culture can develop slash influence themes potentially. They discuss intergenerational trauma and childhood trauma. They discuss their upbringings in detail, struggling to speak up as children. They discuss self-compassion, trauma from OCD, shame, peer support, and much more. It's a very raw and real conversation. Some people may not like it, and others I think may resonate deeply with it. So I hope it helps you in some way. And I invited Chrissy to do this guest episode, and she recorded it long before her company OCD Peers decided to sponsor the show. But it's kind of fitting because they talk about peer support a bit in this anyway. And as you know, Treatment OCD sponsor the weekly Sunday episode, but for this special edition, OCD Peers have decided to support our work. So thanks to OCD Peers for sponsoring this week's special edition of the podcast. OCD Peers is a group support practice designed for ongoing or drop-in support for individuals with OCD, anxiety, PTSD, and support groups for minorities and LGBTQIA+ and mental health. Each day of the week, groups are run at different times to accommodate worldwide time zones and cover different aspects and themes of OCD. Their peer leaders are certified, trained group facilitators and are in recovery from mental health and/or addiction. OCD peer groups are safe, supportive, and they use a HIPAA-compliant platform to protect your privacy. For more information on OCD peers and to sign up for a group, visit them at ocdpeers.com. That's ocdpeers.com, and the link will be in the description. So thank you to those guys for supporting our work. And thanks to Chance for his time and his honesty and openness in this one. And likewise to Chrissy for hers and for her hosting it. And as always, thank you so much to you guys for listening. I deeply appreciate it. And here they are.
Hello and welcome to the OCD Stories podcast. My name is Chrissy Hodges. And thank you so much, Stu, for letting us be guests at the podcast. We're so excited to share our stories and to help normalize the experience of living with OCD. My name is Chrissy Hodges, and I'm a certified peer support specialist in the state of Colorado, working with people to support them and provide referral consultations worldwide. I'm also the founder of OCD Game Changers and the co-founder of OCD Peers and the author of Pure OCD, The Invisible Side of Obsessive Compulsive Disorder. So today, the guest is Chance McNeely, and I'm going to have him introduce himself to you.
Well, thank you, Chrissy, for the opportunity to come and visit with you today. As you said, my name is Chance McNeely, and I actually appeared with, or not appeared, I was with Stu on his podcast. I think it was episode 265. The most downloaded episode ever. So if you've heard my story, I'll try to be brief so you don't have to hear it all again. But so I'm, you know, I've had OCD for as long as I can remember, although I didn't know that until I was about 29. And so, you know, going from childhood, you know, this is a familiar story, right? For me, it was scrupulosity stuff. Of course, I had separation anxiety from my parents and all that as a really little kid. But, you know, I had to pray a certain way until I would, you know, pass out. And for some reason, I thought that would prevent my family from getting AIDS if I did it right. And so, that. And then as I got older, the things just changed and kind of focused on masculinity and in middle school. And then over time that kind of translated into OCD around sexual orientation. And along the way, I had bouts of, you know, am I a serial killer? Am I, or any number? I think I've had everything that there's ever been.
You have.
So, yeah. So, so that being the case, like, I was lucky to receive effective treatment. And after I had some really bad experiences with clinicians, but I was lucky enough to get somebody who was good enough to help me. And I'm thankful for that. And my life is better than I thought that it would or could be just a few years ago. And I am also a former recipient of peer support. And I found that really helpful. As far as being able to be honest about my experience with my clinician, I don't know that I would have developed the courage to do that if it wasn't for seeing other people do it. So, I do provide peer support now. It's really rewarding for me. And I'm, thankful that I also had the courage to go do that because that was triggering to get trained to do that. I think that, does that cover it? I think that's a little short snippet of my background.
Yeah, that was a great introduction. It was kind of like a group check-in. But that's okay. But speaking of groups, Chance also works with OCD peers. And that was a great segue. And also runs groups because he is a certified peer support specialist. So one of the things, I just kind of want to let you know what we're going to be talking about today. Our stories are very similar, and also our backgrounds are really similar as far as where we grew up, some of the traumatic things we've experienced, not only childhood trauma, but also trauma associated with OCD, which we all know does not get talked about enough. So we're going to touch on that, and we're also going to talk about the experience of living in recovery, what that is like as peers. Chance and I both have a very realistic view of what living in recovery with mental illness looks like, which isn't often what's portrayed over social media or just in general. It's usually this finish line where Chance and I talk a lot and work with people to give the realistic impression that recovery is different and unique for everyone, and that there is no standard protocol to follow in order to get to a certain place. And then, of course, we want to talk about peer support, the benefit and normalization of living with OCD. And I have a feeling with just having Chance and I here talking about this stuff, we're probably going to deviate to about 1,000 different topics as well. But don't worry, Stu, we will try to just stay at an hour. So let's talk a little bit about our backgrounds, just in what you just said, Chance. Chance and I both grew up in the South. And one of the things I want to emphasize here is that culture matters. Culture matters when it comes to OCD. We often say the themes don't matter and this doesn't matter. But I find that life circumstances, childhood circumstances, culture, religion, those things really have a heavy influence on how people develop OCD. I don't have any studies to back this up, so I'm just telling you from my own experience and from hearing other people and the influence that might have on specific themes or the development of it. And one of the things that we have in common is the religious scrupulosity piece, kind of the cultural Southern way of doing things and thinking things through. We're very similar that we had OCD for a really long time before we spoke up and asked for help. For me, religious scrupulosity came in the form of praying and feeling like I was sinning and God was punishing me. And so my themes revolved around emetophobia, which is the fear of throwing up as a young child, and also the sexual orientation OCD. When I was 14, and that was probably the longest obsession that I had before my suicide attempt. And the overarching was, if I pray hard enough, if I'm a good enough religious person, God will take these away. Now, one of the things I did not do was tell anyone about what was going on with me. I did not speak a word to anyone for 12 years. Now, this is where I think the culture piece comes in, but it also childhood stuff comes in. I did not grow up in a family where it was, yes, I could have told people what I was going through. However, I probably would have been invalidated in several different ways. And I knew as an 8-year-old, even at that point, that it probably would not have been beneficial to speak what it was going on out loud. Chance, you have a similar story. What do you think about culture being a part of that, but also things that have happened in our childhood contributing to that?
Sure. So I think your culture definitely matters. I mean, if we know that, I think we do know that OCD typically latches on to things that matter to you, or that you care about or value, or maybe at a minimum, you know, there's some sort of stigma around it or something in your culture. And so for me, I kind of feel like that. I know there are people who don't believe in core fears and things like that. That all being said, for me, I do think that if I can pull myself out of symptoms, I can see that at the root of all my obsessions are a fear of rejection and abandonment and isolation and not being worthy of connection or belonging with other people. And so, of course, in my mind, that is, you know, what it takes to be worthy of love and belonging and connection is something that's probably formed pretty young in our childhood. And so I, you know, and this is, makes a lot of sense to me. I have 3 children that are ages 6 to 1. And so I'm watching this stuff happen, like, you know, live in person. And it's a really interesting experience. And I can see how easy it would be for me to, you know, make my kids feel like that they're not inherently worthy of love and belonging. It'd be really easy to do. In fact, I wouldn't have to do it on purpose, right? All I would have to do is parent the way I was parented, and that would achieve that. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about intergenerational trauma and all the hardships that generations and generations of people across the globe have had throughout human history, it's no surprise. I mean, I think everybody who's alive experiences trauma. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we know that this stuff passes on to our kids. And so I think that for me, and again, I don't have a ton of studies that support this. I don't feel like I need them. But I do think that in some way, my development of OCD was a coping mechanism, perhaps a form of dissociation from the realities of my actual childhood life. And that doesn't mean that I was beaten or raped or anything like that. It could mean that I was consistently invalidated, mm-hmm. or consistently, you know, trying to falling short of proving that I was worthy to belong in the family or whatever that it may be that many parents, at least in the culture that I grew up in. I mean, this is not unique to my family. This is like everybody I know. Right. So this whole idea where, you know, a parent talks about unconditional love and belonging, but then their actions and the words don't match that. Mm-hmm. And so children are smart. I think they pick up on that stuff, and it can be really confusing for a kid. And so as a parent, I feel like I'm in a unique position to kind of reflect on this and validate myself for what it was like when I was a little kid.
Mm-hmm. So one of the things that I, before we go to talking about the silence piece and why we didn't speak up and ask for help, which is all related to this, is I find it really interesting that, you know, Chance and I have a really similar background and feeling and learning in our adult life that our childhood was filled with, and you know, just by how he was saying generational trauma, how people have parented through the generations, I've found out in my, you know, my adult life that I experienced emotional neglect, and this is something that was really new to me and really hard to accept. It's, you know, it was very much easier to say, I was the one that developed OCD and everything must be my fault in the family life. The break in the family must have been because I had mental illness. I mean, that was a painful to carry around and believe about myself, and created a lot of shame, but it also created a lot of resentment and feelings of not being heard and not feeling compassion towards what I had experienced. But I find the connection to be really interesting that when we talk about living in an environment where as kids or teenagers or wherever, where someone is telling us one thing and our experience is making us feel a different way. So if I tell someone, hey, remember when this happened and this is how it made me feel? And that person says, that's not how it happened. And then I have to go into the...
Or you shouldn't feel that way, right? You have no reason.
Yes. Or you were too sensitive, or you're being too dramatic. That's not how, you know, that wasn't the way everyone else saw it, bringing in the army. So when we get to that place, then I go into this cycle of going, did I? Well, but I know that that's the way, but other people are telling me wrong. And the interesting thing for me in my adult life, and especially in getting therapy after OCD, behavioral therapy, is, wow, doesn't that really mimic the OCD brain? When I get themes, I will know something isn't real or isn't aligned with who I am, but I can't stop arguing that maybe it is because my brain says that it is. So we don't have any research or information to back up any of this, but I do think it's really important that we start looking at some of these things moving forward. I know, Stu, you've had a lot of people on the podcast, you know, in the last year that have had really incredible insight that's outside of it just being behavioral. And I just wanted to confirm that, like, lots of people are starting to think that there's more to this than just one day OCD showed up and that was it. With that said, I also want to talk about the silence piece. When we talk about pure OCD, the community name for individuals that experience intrusive thoughts with mental rituals, you will hear so many stories of people going, I lived for X amount of years and no one knew. And Chance and I are both like that. So what contributed to you not saying a word about any of this when it showed up?
Because you've said a lot of really important things. I'm trying to figure out what would be the best thing for me to go with. I think that, through my own experience in childhood, I knew that it was more dangerous to speak up than it was to keep it inside. And that's, I mean, kind of the examples you were saying. I mean, if you're, but I'll just use my own children. If my six-year-old comes up to me and shares something with me, and maybe I think the way she's feeling about it is kind of silly, I'm not going to tell her that she's being silly, right? I want to validate her experience because I want her to be able to trust her gut and to know that if she's feeling that way, maybe something's off and maybe she needs, I'm glad that I want her to be able to come and talk to me about that kind of stuff. That's like the opposite environment that I was raised in. And so, and in fact, I remember sharing a very early intrusive thought with my parent and being really invalidated and me being like, well, I ain't ever doing that again. Like, I'm definitely not bringing that. Like, it's clear that this is not going to be helpful. And so you really start at that point, just kind of turning in on yourself. You isolate. I mean, you're there in your childhood household, but you can't be your authentic self because you probably have learned that it's, you're going to suffer more if you share what's going on, or at least you think you do, you will, you know? I think that for me, the, you know, learning at a young age that I could not confide in my parents, the people who verbally said that they loved me unconditionally. but then if you actually hit them with something heavy, like it, apparently not. Mm-hmm. You know, that is, again, to be fair, I think that's how they were parented. I feel super confident that the people who parented my grandparents parented them that way. Mm-hmm. So,
a source of compassion to understand why it's trickled down that way.
Right. And I mean, because, and I think that we have such a hard time admitting this. Like, I had to fight really hard to finally accept the fact that maybe my childhood wasn't perfect. Mm-hmm. Because if it wasn't perfect, then that means that my parents did something wrong. And I'm not allowed to say that.
Which especially comes back to a cultural issue for us. You do not say that in the South. No. It's all in the family in the South.
No, you respect your elders at all costs. And two, I mean, and Chrissy, maybe this was some of the, I mean, I'll just share how it was for me. Maybe you can relate. But, you know, I was actually told that how wonderful my childhood was and how I should be grateful for everything that was going on and how I was loved unconditionally and lucky because there were people starving in Africa. And things like
you were this. Provided for basically Maslow's hierarchy, the basic.
No, but provided for, but then the providers presented it in a way to where I should feel guilty for that. Mm-hmm. Like I should feel really lucky that I have a bed or something. And look, I mean, hey, I get it. Like, there are places in the world where that's not something you take for granted. Huh? But it is still really invalidating to a little kid in America to be like, to be told that, you know, to feel like that they're responsible for their parents' suffering, mm-hmm. right? Like, if your parents work a lot and they're super busy and they come home, they're exhausted or they drink or they don't or whatever they do. And the kid feels like, uh-oh, mom and dad are not okay. A little kid can't process that maybe it's the parent. All they can do is think that it's themselves. All we can do is say, I must be bad. I must. And so we start to change our behavior and we start to do things to try to prevent mama from crying or daddy from hollering, right? And we start to try to manipulate the home dynamic to keep the peace. And as we do that, I can see now it's an act of self-betrayal. And so it's no, you're kind of, to survive through that dynamic, you're kind of dismissing your own intuition. Mm-hmm. And so that's what lines up so beautifully to me with OCD. It is this core inability to accept your own intuition.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
So, right.
Well, and also with OCD, and I think that it's worth mentioning, so many people struggle with self-worth and self-esteem and their inability to trust their gut in making decisions.
Right.
And
is that what intuition means? I think I was trying to say the same thing. I'm Southern. I tried to use a big word. I'm sorry.
So I think that I completely agree with all of this, and it does hit really close to home, but it would line up, I would say, with, for me, I guess, when I think back of, when I think now in my adult life, the degree to which I don't trust myself, because, and this is what I was going to say, it was so much easier to just say all of that's going wrong in the family dynamic is my fault. Even when no one knew that I had a mental health issue, it still became the easier solution. Well, things in the family are this way, or life is this way, because here I am, you know, struggling with these, you know, whether I'm going to vomit today or whether I've betrayed God or what my sexual orientation is or whatever, that I don't even know who I am. When really, as most people with OCD know, in the egotistic way, you know that what you're fighting about in your head, there's no truth to, but you can't win. And if you're also being reinforced in your childhood life or your teenage life, it's almost this triangle of just absolute suffering. I mean, this is why you come out of it with no self-worth, no self-esteem. You can't trust yourself. And then you struggle with, well, how do I build that? And Chance, I 100% agree with you. It's so hard as an adult looking back to say, well, maybe my family had something to do with this. Maybe my attachment styles, maybe my childhood, maybe the family system and the family dynamics, because it feels like you're betraying them.
Or if you're Southern, it feels like the ultimate form of disrespect, right? Like, yes. I mean, that's really what it is. Like, how dare you, right? After all I've done for you, you would say something so hurtful about the parent. And like, but that's the, and I guess that's what I'm getting at. That type of gaslighting, that's the broken record that we've hear in our heads that we've had since we were little kids, many of us. And so, I mean, again, to me,
you can't trust how you're interpreting things, right? Because the world around you is telling you that you're not.
Well, like, I'll use my 6-year-old kid again. If the way I treated her made her think that she couldn't trust her gut, then she's going to start, you know, she views me as the, you know, I'm the all powerful father. It's not because I try to be. That's just the reality. We're mammals. Okay. Like, we are hardwired with our parents. Even if we want to sever the connection, we can't.
Right.
So, like, I mean, like, it's there. I mean, we are, like, you can't escape it. And so, you know, as a parent, I recognize that dynamic and the power that I have in this relationship. And so it's, you know, if I wasn't careful, because I think, I think there is a genetic predisposition for OCD.
Also. Oh, yes, I agree.
And like, it'd be, I mean, the way that my oldest daughter is, like, I think that, you know, it's not out of the realm of possibilities that, you know, some kids are more likely to, you know, shame themselves than others. And she,
probably because they have the anxious gene and then they had anxious attachment.
Probably so. But all I'm trying to say is that, I mean, it would not take much probably for my daughter to manifest OCD symptoms at the age of 6. And if she feels invalidated, she typically does turn in on herself and think that it's her fault. Mm-hmm. Right. And so, I don't think I've done that to her as a parent, but I'm aware, I see it, and I work hard to nip it in the bud. Mm-hmm. Right. And so if you do have that genetic predisposition but you have a parent who is not trying to nip it in the bud, but is instead pouring gas on the fire, then you're probably going to have a pretty hard life.
Well, I think this is a really important message too, to supporters of people with OCD, because people, I feel like, don't know what to do. And we're all instinctual. I mean, I'm not a parent, but if I were, I already know I would be instinctual on how I would parent because of how I was parented. Right. And so when you throw OCD into the mix for parents, to support the kid when you know it's OCD goes against their own instincts.
Yeah, well, I mean, let's just, you know, talk about being triggered. People who don't have OCD get triggered. You don't have to have an anxiety disorder to have triggers. And so if a kid is acting out, not listening to you, any parent, you could probably have a flashback to your own childhood where your mom or dad was hollering at you for similar behavior. Mm-hmm. And so you do that. And it's like a release of the pain that you're in, because, you know, if I was a good parent, my child would not be acting like this. Mm-hmm. Right. And so as parents, we can very easily discharge our own pain and suffering onto our child, who they're not going to say, oh, mom and dad are just, you know, trying to make sure that I'm a good kid. They're going to be like, I am bad.
Mom and dad are just projecting.
Yeah, mom and dad are projecting their untherapized emotions onto me. That's not what a kid thinks. They don't know that. And so we just internalize it all. You know?
Yeah. Well, for me, just to kind of full circle it back, you know, the silence piece. And I think, again, it's important to recognize that a lot of people, when they have intrusive thoughts, you know, unless they have a very open and supportive environment, are usually going to internalize that because of the shame and are going to, again, I'm going to emphasize what I said before, it's way easier to say, I am the problem. I am the identified patient because of stigma, right? Because we still have such a huge issue with stigma, you know, that's vast. It doesn't matter what the culture is. The stigma is still there. So it's way easier for the person suffering to just naturally go down the path of, if things are bad, it's my fault because I'm the one with mental health issues. But for the silence piece for me is, and I'm just going to be really frank here. For very many years, even in my advocacy, you could probably dig back into some of my videos. I probably said, because I just wasn't awake yet to what I had been through as a child, I probably said, well, I just didn't tell anybody because I was so ashamed of the content. Well, I mean, yeah, the fear of vomiting is kind of shameful. It's kind of silly, but it was an actual life rattling, changing fear for me at 8 years old. And it's come to my attention in my adult life. What kind of 8-year old child who experienced this kind of break in reality in one day of developing that fear and then religious scrupulosity on top of that, did not run into their parents' arms when they picked them up from school and say, I have something to tell you. In fact, I was so, this is so personal, but whatever, it's in my book. It's not like anyone can't read it. But in fact, I actually had an accident at school that day. From the amount of anxiety I had stomach issues, and I had an accident, an after-school program in the bathroom as an 8-year-old. And it was because of those damn belts. You know those belts, those loop belts, the cloth belt? I couldn't get it undone. And I had been holding this anxiety in all day, and I got sick. I didn't throw up, thank goodness. That would have been awful. But I got sick, and I had an accident. I didn't tell my parents that either. I was 8 years old. Yeah. I got picked up from school. I didn't tell them my entire life had changed. I didn't tell them that I had an accident. I hid it all. And I've always believed from day one, I just didn't want to tell because I was embarrassed. No, I didn't want to tell because I wouldn't have been believed. Yeah. Or I would have been shamed. Or just dismissed. And again, this is not a slight at my family. This is just the reality of what people do. I have dismissed and not believed and you know, invalidated people my entire life because I just didn't know any different, right? And so
that's the behavior that was modeled to you. And it has been modeled for generations, right?
But I think in general, and also this is important to peer support, in general, all of us are hardwired to listen, to respond. I mean, probably not hardwired, probably taught that. But until you go and learn how to listen, to understand and listen, to validate, we just don't. And I say that just to say that, you know, just to take the, I'm not like shifting blame, but at the same time, it's important to own your story for OCD. It's important to own, especially if your experience revolves around, well, it's just all my fault because I developed this. Well, I just didn't tell anybody because I was embarrassed and ashamed. Is it? Was it? What really happened? What's really going on? And why is that still relevant?
So, and so what comes to mind for me right now, I think this is important to share, is that I've been working really hard, had been, on self-compassion work, like really trying to sustain that. And I talked about it with Stu and how rewarding and impactful and meaningful it is whenever I'm able to sustain that feeling, even and maintain the work and you know, however brief of periods of time it may be. I was like, damn, I wish I could keep some of this for longer periods of time. And I finally came to terms with the fact that You know, I think it is childhood trauma that keeps me from maintaining that self-compassion. Now, why is that important for OCD? Well, and at least for me, shame and judgment and not feeling worthy is the whole reason I perform compulsions in the first place. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, if you can practice and learn and live in a self-compassionate way, I have, through different periods, found it really easy to not be compulsive. Now, the intrusive thoughts might still come, but I just have a lot easier time being dismissive and teaching my brain that those thoughts are irrelevant, which is what we need to do. But when you're so filled with shame and judgment of yourself, which is the opposite of self-compassion, it's really hard to not be compulsive. Mm-hmm. And so on this self-compassion journey, I finally came to terms with the fact that, oh shit, this has been going on forever. Mm-hmm. And maybe my childhood wasn't as perfect as I was told that it was. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to have to grapple with this if I'm going to live the full life that I want to live. Mm-hmm. Right. And so it's kind of disheartening to be like, yep, after you get done with your ERP treatment, you've got this other dumpster fire to deal with.
And I always talk about this, and I think this is important because we don't often talk about this in advocacy, and you don't hear it a lot of times in therapy, is yes, we need to deal with the behavioral symptoms first. Let's figure out what's going on in the amygdala and how to change our response to that. But then a lot of times the message comes into play of, okay, your behavioral symptoms are taken care of. Go have life and it's going to be great, which is immediately when most people either bolt from OCD and go, I never want to think about this again because I'm cured and I'm over it and whatever. And then they suffer because OCD goes back or they're in denial or whatever else. A lot of us dove right into grief, right into why me? And I'm behind.
I dove right into bourbon.
And then we struggle with addiction. Lots of people struggle with addiction, not only during symptoms to survive, right? But then afterwards, when we feel like, well, my behaviors are under control, why don't I feel good? Why? And that's when the usual message is, well, just have self-compassion and mindfulness and acceptance. And you're going, I don't know what I'm accepting. What am I accepting? For me, if someone had brought up acceptance right after therapy, I would have been like, what am I accepting? I was privileged to get therapy. I did everything right. But I still feel bad. I still feel sad. I'm still in stigma. I'm still in shame. So what do you want me to accept? That this is my life now? That, you know, I think the message gets lost that you are allowed to grieve. You're allowed to go through this process of looking back and going, I didn't cause this shit, but it disrupted my life for X amount of years.
So one of the things you just said made me think of something that is important to me, at least. So you said that the struggle with acceptance after ERP or whatever, or during ERP, I hate the word acceptance, is just a struggle for most of us, I think.
You certainly wouldn't think so if you're on social media, because acceptance is the way. But the reality is most people are like, I don't even know what that means. And no one wants to explain it.
Well, the part of acceptance, one of the many parts of acceptance I struggled with, which what you said reminded me of, is I have always felt the need to accept that I have OCD. And it's a, I always butcher this word, it's a phenomenon.
Right.
And yeah. I being told that I have to accept that it just is. It's just something that just got dealt a bad hand of cards. Something about that has always felt extremely like invalidating to me. And I've never accepted it. Number one, like it kind of defies logic to me, because I remember what I was like when I was a little bitty kid, which was like, you know, wide-eyed, bushy-tailed and happy. And then I remember that ending. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, this whole idea that, oh, you know, it's not your fault you have OCD. It's nobody's fault you have OCD. That's just how it is. Just like if you had diabetes. Right. And so that, to me, that's just, I just refuse to accept that. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad I've refused to accept that, even though I've suffered a lot over it, because I kind of feel like I'm starting to understand more. And I think that to tell somebody who has suffered like we've suffered that they don't get any closure around it is bullshit. Mm-hmm. Like, to me.
Well, and a different way to put that too is we can't just keep relying on get behavioral therapy and then life is going to be great. We have to still, as a community, start to look at different ways that different things that people can do after therapy. How can I explore this? What are other factors in this? How can, you know, versus, when, as you were talking, one of the things that came to my mind is this: when I first started doing advocacy and I first started understanding OCD and the way that it is and the way that we all talk about it and think about it, it's this, well, you learn how to manage it when symptoms come up, but you know what? Every single day you're walking around and boom, symptoms could hit you. And so you're living your life in terror. I mean, I do know too. I mean, I have long-term patterns when I move, when I change jobs, if, you know, I have problems in a relationship, yes, OCD is going to show up. Okay. So then I can predict that and I can look for patterns. So when it does show up, I'm ready to go. Right. But again, it's this whole, it hit me out of the blue when I was a child. I was 8 years old. It hit me and changed my whole life. So as an adult, I still have that traumatic memory of things were going okay. And then boom, life changed in an instant. And this is why a lot of times people have the fear of when things are going well, they go, well, I'm terrified now. What's going to go wrong? Because remember when I was 5 and this, remember when I was 20 and life seemed to be okay. And then OCD hit. And so now I have to live in terror that's going to happen. And I'm not allowed to just enjoy when things are okay because the ball is going to drop at some point. And this is the information we're kind of being fed about OCD. And you can accept it or refuse to accept it and continue to dig into and encourage the researchers in our community. Let's do more. Let's figure this out. And also use the people with lived experience. Listen to them too.
I think, well, you know, first of all, Brené Brown calls that dress rehearsing tragedy. And it is something, I mean, that to me, like, that kind of is what anxiety is.
I'm not laughing at Brené Brown.
No, I know, you're laughing at me. But like, that's what we do, right? I mean, that's what anxiety is about, I think. So now I lost my train of thought because you laughed at my Brené Brown comment.
I know. It's just that if y'all don't know, anytime anything and ever anything happens with Chance, all of a sudden he'll text me and be like, as Brené says.
Well, and so side note, since I forgot what I was going to say, when I came across Brené Brown's work, she's not a person that I would have ever even like clicked on a video for her. Certainly would have never read a book. I would have never read any of her stuff. And for some reason I came across her shame stuff at the right time when I was ready to hear it. And I guess this was after my ERP stuff, and it helped me to realize that everybody suffers. Right. And so it was kind of like this first, the first time I believed that, you know, yes, I've had a really shitty life. I didn't want to say that, but I've had a really hard life with OCD. Mm-hmm. And then it was kind of refreshing to hear from her work that suffering is, in fact, the human condition. Mm-hmm. And I'm not uniquely flawed because of the fact that I have suffered. And so that's why I like her, because I found her at the right time in the right headspace to learn enough to gain the courage to keep working on this stuff. Mm-hmm. Because when I got done with the ERP treatment, I wanted to act like this never happened. And I'm going to go back into the world and never tell anyone that this happened, and everything's going to be great. And that's just not what happened.
Right. And so with that, I want to segue to two different points. First, I want to talk about, and all of this I think is cumulative to talk about this point. So Chance and I both consider ourselves in recovery, meaning we have gone through effective behavioral treatment and then continue to work on living a better life with OCD. Some days are good, some days are bad. But I think that also one of the things that happens in, when we talk about advocacy right now, I'm talking about social media, which isn't necessarily advocacy. It's just people posting about OCD. So, but when we see that, we just see people posting, and all of a sudden we can start to get OCD about that. Well, this person says to do this, and this person is living their best life, and this person says they don't have symptoms ever again, and this person says they don't even have intrusive thoughts, which all, as we know, is really dangerous to say any of those black and white terms. But I think it's important to bring up, and Chance and I both run groups and work with people individually, so we hear this a lot. So it's not just our own experience. It is hearing directly from the community. The issue of people who maybe are in treatment or have been through treatment and still believe everybody else is better but me. Now, we do know this is also a kind of a phenomenon for OCD. It's the black and white thinking. Well, that person is doing that, and so they must be better. That person is saying that, and it must be better. So we wanted to shed some reality on this, in case this is your experience and you feel like, I'm the only one, you know, I should feel better, I should have reached this finish line by now. We just wanted to talk a little bit about our own experiences and help to normalize what recovery can look like instead of what everyone else wants to believe it should look like. What are your thoughts?
So for me, when I was in treatment, proper treatment, I would start to have longer periods of times without severe suffering, right? And I'd be like, oh, that's great. And then I'd be like, yeah, but it's coming back. And then there I would go. And so for me, what peer support did is helped me to believe that that is the right path to be on, right? Because seeing people who are in recovery still suffer, while that could be demoralizing, it's also like, oh, like what I'm experiencing right now is kind of how this is going to go. Mm-hmm. And so, I think a lot of people, I know I was very resistant to treatment for OCD because I thought I'd find out that it was thoughts were real, or that it wouldn't, I know OCD is a thing, but my stuff's worse, when we're in treatment, we oftentimes, I think, look for evidence for that to be true. And so if I'm in treatment and I'm having a bad day, and then I go get on Instagram and see somebody who's saying that they're living their best life, then I'm like, uh-oh, I knew that this wasn't going to work for me, right? And then we go right back down the compulsive rabbit hole because we're doomed, right? Mm-hmm. And so I just think, I suffer fairly frequently. I drank last night for no real reason, and I've been suffering today because I guess maybe that's a moral hangover. I'm not trying to trigger anyone, but like I'm shaming myself about that. Mm-hmm. And so I try to be open with people. It kind of upsets me or makes me sad when people share with me that they can't wait to be where I am, or that it must be so wonderful to be well. And that parts of that are true, but wellness doesn't mean the absence of symptoms.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. Now it may be less symptoms, or for me, like I'm, you know, when I do start to suffer, I can typically get out of it in like an hour or two, as opposed to like 1 or 2 decades. Right. Like that's that is the improvement. Right. But if I fixate on that, I should not be ever be sick at all. Well, then I'm screwed because mm-hmm. I'm just going to, I mean, I'm kind of guaranteeing at that point that I'm going to get sick again.
Yeah. And for me, when in doing, you know, I've been doing advocacy since 2012 or something. I don't know. And when I first started speaking out about this, there was this really driving need of, I have to instill hope. I have to instill hope. I have to save everybody. But I was basing that off of, well, I have to save everybody the way that I was saved, which I was not saved. I just was in a certain progression of my recovery. And that's where I happened to be. Since then, I have been up and down. I've learned a lot. I've hurt, I've suffered, you know, and so it's been a really interesting journey to be able to reflect on, well, from 2018 to 2020, my life sucked with OCD. But then from 2015 to 17, it was awesome. Like, right. So my advocacy may have reflected at that point, there's so much hope and you can get here and blah, blah, blah. And then when I go back in the depths of it, I almost don't even believe myself and hate all of my advocacy. And so that's why advocacy is hard. That's why it should not be taken lightly. But also it's important to understand that recovery for me is going to look way different than recovery for Chance and recovery for everyone. And when we, let's just be real here. Everybody is chasing the goal that I will never have symptoms again. Every single one of us wants that. We want to wake up and one day it's all over, or we found the key. That's the bottom line. So the only way that I accept the word acceptance is in this realm. I have to accept that today I might have symptoms. If I fight against that, I'm going to suffer instead of just being present in the reality of what today is giving me. Yesterday and the day before, based on specific circumstances in my life was a shit show. I was exhausted. I was triggered. I was in symptoms because of life circumstances. I slept 9 hours last night and woke up and I was like, oh, blue sky. Right?
Right. Yeah.
And so
well, not just that, we can have like, you don't have to label one day as good or bad. You can have a bad morning and have a good mid morning.
I mean, who in the world has a good day when they have a meeting at 8 a.m. that they have to drive to?
Nobody.
So I knew yesterday was going to be horrible. But at the same time, like, I have gotten to a place in my recovery where I woke up this morning and said, oh, thank goodness, the edge is going to be off today. I'm not going to feel the way I did the last 2 days because I was tired and I was this, 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 and this, and this. Am I saying that symptoms aren't going to show up? No, they did. But I was better equipped to face them, whereas yesterday they just overwhelmed me. But I'm going to tell you something right now. I don't take that and project it out to say that I'm not in recovery. I am in recovery because I can say that.
Yeah.
And that's the difference. The difference is if you're looking for a finish line, if you're looking for the, I am going to cross this and everything is going to be okay. That's going to be when you die. Right? I mean, because life, there is no finish line in life. And we tend to project our whole OCD experience as life.
Yeah. Well, and you said something too, that I think is important. I have benefited tremendously from advocates, and I will always be super grateful mm-hmm. for you and Rose Cartwright and Aaron Harvey, because y'all talked about this hard stuff before it was trendy or safe to do it. Mm-hmm. And so hear that and know that it's true. That also being said, you know, a lot of advocates, I feel like, and this is not being negative, I think it's something that we all struggle with, I think that, you know, you get through ERP treatment and you're looking for your self-worth. You're trying real hard to find it.
Yes.
And I think that many people get into advocacy hoping to find it. Okay. And
well, because having OCD is the opposite of being able to find self-worth, right?
Yeah, well, I think we're all looking for some avenue to find self-worth,
yes, well,
right?
True. Yeah.
And I mean, you know, like to be clear, like I'm sitting here talking to you, there's some amount of positive self-worth going on here. Like the fact that I'm with you talking, I'm not saying that in a negative way, but what I am saying is that when we are, it's possible that as an advocate, that when we suffer and we don't be forthcoming about it, that we can't because we've attached our self-worth to being well.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And, so good. Yeah.
And then whenever that happens, I've kind of been there before. Number one, I'm invalidating my own experience, right? I'm like, hey, look at me and my self-worth and my wellness, right? Mm-hmm. But then I'm also hurting other people, mm-hmm. other people who need to see me, the guy in recovery who's still having good and bad days. And so I, again, I'm not picking on anybody because Lord knows I've been looking for self-worth in lots of strange places for 33 years. But I just want to say that, like, be aware of the fact that therapists, clinicians, advocates, all human beings on earth are trying to obtain a sense of self-worth. And when you hook that up, when it's conditional, when you're trying to achieve it, you put blinders on and you don't show up as authentically as you otherwise could.
Mm-hmm. No, I agree with that. And I do want to kind of segue into the last topic of the difference between kind of advocacy and peer work, because sometimes they can get conflated. People who are peer support specialists are not people who just have lived experience. They're just speaking out and just deciding that they can help guide you through stuff. That is not a peer support specialist. It's really important to make that distinction. And I'm also just going to be bold out here and say, if anybody's asking you to pay them money because they have lived experience, please ask for their credentials. Please ask for whether they've been trained. You can ask to see a certificate. You can ask to see for, do not exchange money with people if they are just saying, I have lived experience and I can help you. Anybody who's trained in peer support specialists or as a peer support specialist would never say, I have lived experience, I can help you. We have lived experience because we've been there and we can meet you where you're at. That's what we do. We don't help you. We don't give you advice. We don't pull you along and we don't tell you the key. So that's the difference between that and peer support specialists. And so just really quickly before we wrap up, just wanted to say, and I will also chime in on this too, but peer support, Chance, how beneficial has it been for you? How beneficial is it to give it to other people?
So I attribute my state of recovery to peer support in a large part. I don't think that I would have had the courage to do the hard work without it. I just could not, even though I kind of intellectually knew that I had OCD, I could not believe that my experience could be OCD. Right. And so it really helped me to believe that enough to go and do the treatment. As far as providing peer support, it's a very rewarding experience for me. And it's also really challenging. And here's why. Chrissy just said that we're not clinicians. We don't help you, guide you, you know, make you well. And it's hard to not try to do that. Okay.
Because, save everyone.
Yeah. Because, well, yeah. Hey, I just told you I'm looking for my self-worth here. And so like if I meet with somebody and they're suffering really badly, particularly if I meet with them multiple times, I do want to help them. Mm-hmm. Like I want them to get better badly. Right. And I've even told Chrissy before, like, well, I guess I suck. right? Because I haven't healed everyone. And that's not the role. That's not what we do. And so I say that a little bit with empathy towards people who may be out there who feel like it, that their only sense of self-worth is to go try to heal people. Right. And so there are people in the world that are like, hey, I'm a coach and I'm going to heal you. I mean, I used to watch some of their stuff compulsively and be like, I need to talk to this person. Right. Mm-hmm. And that those kind of folks, obviously, for a variety of reasons, probably need to feel like they can heal people. Mm-hmm. And the reality is that that's just not how this goes. And So I guess I would just kind of end on the other thing, because I think this is important. Peer support also taught me that I am my own advocate.
Yes.
I never walked into a doctor's office and was like, let me tell you what's about, you know, I'm going to give you a piece of my mind. All right. And so at some point you kind of have to get to where you can stand up for yourself and be an active participant in your own treatment. Mm-hmm. And peer support, I think, helped to empower me to be there mm-hmm. and to do that. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, it helps you, it helps normalize all of those feelings of maybe the hierarchy in the clinic with the clinician, and helps you to feel like that you can be, you know, authoritative and talk to a clinician as if you're a real person, as opposed to this broken thing that this doctor is supposed to fix.
That is actually one of the core competencies of being a peer support specialist, is promoting, empowering people to be advocates of their own recovery, and also in shared decision making, meaning you do not, unless you are court ordered, and sometimes that's also not appropriate, unless you're court ordered, you have a voice in your recovery. You have, and that's one of the things that we do as peer supports. One of the things I try to do in advocacy is to help empower you. Now, for me, really quickly, before we got to do Stu's last questions, and we'll have to speed through them, by the way. He's probably like, y'all, shut up. Stop talking and end. But we're two Southerners. So for me, peer support was life-changing. I received peer support from an individual who did not have OCD, but was trained to be able to teach me that it is okay to take the reins of my own recovery. And it was life-changing to me. It helped me to really embrace the fact that I can grieve what I have been through, but also he gave me the permission to have agency over how I look at my recovery and the choices that I make to get better, instead of just listening to, oh, you should do this and then life will be great. Giving peer support to me, and I work with people, Chance and I both do. We do one-on-one, and we also run groups through OCD Peers. So if you're interested, I'm sure Stu will provide all the information. Giving peer support has been one of the most healing parts of my recovery that there is. I have learned so much by people trusting me and telling me their experience, and then I get to identify my own experience with theirs. And so it heals me in the same way. I'm providing a service, but I'm also getting normalized by people trusting me and helping me to see that I'm not alone, the same way that I am allowing them to know that they are not alone. And this is how we build community. This is how we build the reality of living with mental health. And this is how we break down stigma. So yay, peer support. Okay. Questions. Ready, Chance? We got to quick fire these. You ready? Okay. First question. If you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell him?
I would say something along the lines of, hey, you're asking yourself the wrong question. You're trying to figure out what's wrong with you, and you need to be asking yourself what happened to you.
Ooh, trauma-informed care. I mean, that's the premises of trauma-informed care.
I know, that's why I said it.
Well, I know, but it's so good. It like gave me chills. Okay, second. If you have a, I was going to answer the first one, but I'm not going to, because we don't have time. You have a billboard. What do you want written on it?
CPTSD.
Complex PTSD is a real thing. And the DSM sucks.
All right. Let's see.
Might need to edit that part out, the last part.
At this point in our conversation, if I had a billboard, I support this statement, Brené Brown, shame can't live in the light.
Yep.
Okay. Lastly, is there anything else that you wish you could have said?
Just to encourage everybody who's listening to be willing to take the risk that we don't know everything that there is to know about OCD.
Yes.
And that when you consider the fact that in just a very short few decades, we went from having like no treatment to a gold standard of treatment, and that's phenomenal and amazing. But that doesn't mean that it's been perfected. And to be open to the idea that that it's not perfect and that we can continue to work on it and improve it. And I think it was Stu who one time said that we should not be dogmatic about the treatment for OCD.
I agree. And if there was anything that I would have said, it would be along those same lines. And that is, you do not have to settle on this was my fault that it just showed up. And now I have to worry every day it's going to show up again and live in fear. Keep searching, keep looking for different modalities of treatment for different people that can help you in your recovery. Never stop. Life is learning how to get better in recovery. That's what life is. There is no finish line, but you know, the race can be just as rewarding as long as you're walking alongside the wrong people or the right people. I mean, the wrong sometimes too, because they can teach us good lessons. Damn, I just ruined it.
No, you did good.
Anyway, thank you so much for joining us, Stu. Thank you for having us on. It's been a pleasure. Chance, thank you for coming on and sharing all of your experiences with us.
Thank you, Chrissy, and thank you, Stu. Appreciate both of your work, and honored to be back on the podcast. So, thanks.
Yay. Okay. Well, thank you, and hope you have a good day. Take it away, Stu.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip / donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks to OCD Peers for sponsoring this week's special edition of the podcast. To find out more about their peer support groups for OCD and to meet others, head to ocdpeers.com, or the link will be in the description. And quick disclaimer, guys, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.